Hey, it's Antrice, and welcome to the Savvy Painter Podcast. This episode is sponsored by Gamblin Artist Colors, and we've teamed up to create a very special episode for you. I collected questions from you, and Gamblin is here to answer them.
Hi, I'm Robert Gamblin. I'm the founder of Gamblin Artist Colors. I founded the company in 1980. We now have a wonderful facility that gives excellent work to 25 people, and we make only materials based on oil for oil painting and printmaking.
Robert answers questions about pigments, how Gamblin developed their line, artists they've worked with to create colors, and he shares the strangest stories for pigment sources. Also, I'm sure you've seen the new blue pigment discovered up in Oregon. That story has been a hot topic on social media for some time. Well, Robert was able to play with some samples of it, and he shares his assessment.
Well, hello. My name is Mary, and I'm a product specialist at Gamblin.
I also get a quick question in with Mary. She answers Edgar Soberon's question about why some paints have more oil separation in the tubes. And then next up is Pete Cole.
Hi, I'm Pete Cole. I'm the president of Gamblin Artist Colors.
Pete answers questions about toxicity. He dispels some of the myths around cadmiums and oil painting. And he gets into the nitty-gritty details of Christina Rotelli's question about cap sizes. After listening to this episode, you might want some of the resources that Robert, Mary, and Pete mention. About once a month, Gamblin sends out helpful tips for oil painters and printmakers, and they've put together a special PDF download for Savvy Painter listeners who sign up for their email list. Go to gamblincolors.com/savvypainter to get their monthly tips and the free download that shows you step-by-step how to varnish your paintings. The folks over at Gamblin answered questions from 25 different artists. This is an episode jam-packed with information you can use every day in your studio. So I'll start by talking with Robert Gamblin, then Mary, and then Pete Cole weighs in with his expertise. So this episode has a couple parts to it. Okay, here we go. Here is Robert Gamblin. Welcome, Robert. Thank you so much for doing this with me.
It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here.
Can you tell me a little bit about Gamblin and how you started it?
I'd be happy to. I went to art school in the late 60s. And when I graduated, there was really sort of no one waiting to hire us to, you know, with all of our smarts and all of our creativity. And so, as most artists do, you have to get creative with how you make a living. So for 10 years, I did a variety of jobs. And then the last job that I had was a custom acrylic plastic fabrication. And that was a pivotal point in my life in the sense that when I started that job, I was working for my uncle. He would bring in a stack of work orders for the day and said, okay, here we go. You know, how do you organize your day? And I had no conception of project thought or how to actually organize production. And within a relatively short period of time, I could take a stack of papers and sort them and knew what my cut list was going to be so that I could maximize my table saw time and then maximize my table space. And it really taught me what I always thought of as production thought. But for doing all of those jobs, none of them were close enough to painting to satisfy me. And after having gone through art school, I really had dedicated my life to art. And I wanted a living as close to oil painting as possible. And since I was skilled with working with my hands and skilled with formulation through many years in the kitchen, moving into making oil colors, it seemed like a fantastic thing to do. Like, how could you possibly do this? And in the end, it seemed like, how come it took you so long to figure this out? It's so obvious that this is perfect for what you should be doing. You understand painting. You understand how materials come together. You understand how when you apply force to one set of raw materials, you end up with something else. So in the end, it was just sort of like, gosh, why did it take me so long? And then came the educational aspect, because I had gone through art school up to the point where I was about to enter into a master's program to become a teacher. And at that point, I decided, you know, I'm really sort of done with school. I'm not going to do this. I'm going to find another way. But through the business, I realized that I ended up doing as much teaching as if I had become an art instructor, because one of the things that was really missing in the world at that time, and still we do a tremendous amount of our effort in this area, is to help educate artists about their materials and processes, because, you know, to be truthful, there's not a lot of that that comes through most art education. And so we really end up doing a lot of teaching about materials. In the early years, it was just me going around the country, visiting every art school I could. And now we have, we've grown to the point where we have like a team of people. We have 10 or 12 artists that are living around the country who go in to do teaching for us.
Oh, wow.
But that was the beginning. I mean, just purely personally wanting to have a life and a livelihood as close to painting as possible. I end up thinking that I didn't end up close to painting. I actually ended up inside painting.
In the paint.
Yeah.
So how did you decide that you were going to make oil paint? I mean, most companies make a lot of other stuff and you only make oil paint. Why is that? How did you get there?
Well, I was an oil painter, and I never wanted more than a small company. And we still are a very small company. And oil colors has been central to, you know, the history of art over the last 600 years. I mean, the most powerful images that we have are done as oil paintings. The most viable artworks that we have in our culture are oil paintings. And that's no accident. There is no other painting medium that is as powerful and as versatile as oil painting is. And so it was a natural to just become a manufacturer of oil colors and printmaking inks based on oil and all of those mediums. You know, it seems like, oh, you only do oil colors? Well, to us, it really looks like a lot of work, and it's very complicated. Many, many things that we make, and we're very happy to just be experts at oil painting and oil painting related materials and not have to get into acrylics or watercolors or pastels or things like that.
Mm, yeah. So then you can really dig into that particular medium and just be the complete focused experts on that.
Yeah. We're focused. We're dedicated to one thing.
I have questions for you from listeners of the podcast, and I'd love to start off with this first one comes from Matthew Lopez. So Matthew's asking, what is the strangest story for a pigment source for your paints? What pigment do you wish you could use but don't because it's too expensive?
That is an interesting question. I agree. It brings up some very pivotal points in our history. The first thing I think about is in 1989, we were given a project that we've always called the Smithsonian Project. And the Smithsonian Center, Support Center, which is outside of Washington, wanted a whole set of colors that, and most of them are obsolete pigments, to use in their testing. You know, if you're going to try to find out what's the best solvent to use to clean lead tin yellow, you can't just go to a valuable painting on the wall and just start doing experiments with it. And so they wanted 200 different paint formulations so that they could do destructive testing on it.
Oh, wow.
And find out what the best thing to use was. So this was, you know, a valuable project for them. But for me as a paint maker, it gave me a reach back into our history, 200 or 300 years, where I never would have had the time to gather all of these materials together and just spend time making color. But they needed this. And so they paid me to do this work for them. And so it gave me this look back into our history that was just incredibly valuable. And the most important thing I think that came to me is many of us who are interested in this read back about these stories of lapis blue and antimony red and all of these obsolete things that we no longer have with us and think like, oh, wow, what? I wish I had access to that. That would be really cool. And after having made them, I could see that I got a tremendous appreciation for where we are now in the history of art as artists. We are living at the richest time in history for color. There has never been such a wealth of pigments available to the artists. And yes, we have lost things, But everything that we have lost, we've lost for a very good reason. We've lost because that material was highly toxic and it was replaced by something that was much more benign, or that material was not particularly light fast, and so it's been replaced by something that is very light fast, or a material that was incredibly difficult to produce in terms of its texture, and it was produced now by something that is very easy to work with. So everything that we've lost for a good reasons. And this is literally the richest time in history to be living as an artist in terms of pigments. But to answer the question more directly, there are a few, very few things from that time that I think would be fun to be able to produce. And one of them was ultramarine blue from lapis. Now, having made ultramarine blue from lapis several times, I personally feel that the synthetic version that we've had available to us since the 1860s, what we think of as ultramarine blue today, or some companies call French ultramarine, that blue is more beautiful than genuine ultramarine blue is, in my personal opinion, as an oil paint. But still, I wish I had it just because it has this incredible storied history.
Yeah.
And as far as new pigments, just a few years ago here in Oregon at Oregon State University, a scientist developed what has been called Yin-Min Blue.
Yes, I read about that.
And so we were one of the first people to get samples of it, and we turned it into paint. And we were disappointed for a couple reasons. One is that if we were to produce a 37-milliliter tube of it, it would have to have a cost of about $200 a tube.
Wow. Why is that?
Well, because it has three basic components in its makeup, and two of them are rare earth minerals. And that just really increases the cost of it as a raw material. And so we have a list of artists who still want to use it, still want to buy it, regardless of the cost. And so when it is finally available, we will buy a small amount and we will produce it on a very limited basis. But, you know, the price was disappointing. And the other thing, to tell you the truth, the color's not so great.
Really?
It's about somewhere in the middle of ultramarine blue and phthalo blue in terms of its tinting strength. And it's a little bit like cobalt blue in terms of its color. So, I mean, if you take cobalt blue and you add, you know, maybe 15% phthalo blue to it, then you end up with a dead ringer for this Yin-Min blue for the cost of Series 2 colors.
Right.
So it's disappointing on a couple levels. So I think that what I wish is like, oh, it would have been fabulous and I wish it had been cheap. But none of those things are actually happening.
Oh, that's such a disappointment, because that I keep seeing that going around on the internet, and everybody's like, oh my God, have you seen this blue?
Yeah. But the craziest thing that I think we have been able to do is our Torrid Gray. I mean, we were essentially 20 years ago or more found that we had all this pigment accumulating in our dust extractor. Hey, yes, what it does, it accumulates pigment dust. Well, for the listener to understand what I'm talking about, is that wherever we have a bag of open pigment, wherever there is a mixer where dry pigment is being put into oil, there is an air collection port right at that location. So any dust that tries to escape is captured into the dust collection system. And then that, you know, accumulates in the bottom of the dust collector. And we end up with this pigment that is literally a mix of every single pigment that we use. And so we collect that. And then for more than 20 years, we have produced what we call Tort Gray. Tort Gray is our dust collector. And so I'm sure that many of your listeners have had a chance to try Tort Gray, because we have literally produced, I don't know, it could be 200,000 or 300,000 tubes of Tort Gray we've produced over the years from our dust collector. And we will continue to do that, because the option is we either send this dust to the landfill or we turn it back into paint.
That is a great story. I'm curious, though, how do you maintain consistency in the color then if it's pulled from?
We don't even try. Every single batch of Tort Gray is different from every single batch of Tort Gray that has ever existed. So it's totally unique every time we make it.
Oh my God. I have to admit, I haven't used it yet, but now I'm so curious. It sounds like it would be fun. There's somebody was telling me that they do paintings. There's just kind of like a randomizer for when you need to kind of play with your creativity levels, and they literally just reach into their bag and pull three random paints out and then make a painting with that. And so it's in some ways like nicer though. It reminds me a little bit of that, but sounds like a lot of fun.
It is.
So speaking of colors and invention of colors, Jenny Stringleman says that she woke up really excited from a dream and that she was painting with a new color called gray gold. And it's such a vivid memory that she went straight online to see if it existed. So she's asking, is this the kind of thing that you dream about? So, I mean, I guess the base question is, where do you get your colors from?
Yes. Well, it is really one of the most unusual questions I think I've had. And it was interesting to think about. I actually don't dream about colors that we don't have, but I have dreamt about colors that we do have, especially with color combinations. And the most recent dream that I had about color combination is I had a dream about this mountain, and it was a very sort of columnar shaped mountain with almost kind of a flat top. In fact, I'm here in the studio. I'm looking at the painting that I made from it of the dream as I'm talking to you. And the dream was about this total rapturous beauty of yellow ochre in the sun and ultramarine blue in the shadow of this hill. And at the base of the hill, climbing up it, was a village. And it's interesting to me that the dream was so beautiful. The yellow ochre was so golden and glowing, and the ultramarine blue was so deep and rich. And that's my struggle with this painting, is try to work it so that it comes somewhere close to the intensity of my dreams. So yeah, so I have dreamt about color a little bit.
That's fantastic. So the next question comes from John Seed. John was actually a guest on the podcast. He writes for the Huffington Post, and he was wondering if Gamblin has made custom colors for any well-known artists.
We have made custom colors in the past. We do it very rarely because most artists are, of course, very happy with being able to choose from 100 colors and then mix the millions of colors that they can make from those. But occasionally, there's an artist who desires, and it's mostly for shortcut purposes, or sometimes because they want a very specific working property built into that color, and we've made it for them. For many years, we made a custom white for James Rosenquist. He wanted a white that had a very soft feel to it and would take a longer time to dry, and he had a specific idea on how that should be, and so we made that for him for many years. One of the champions of our company from almost the beginning was Nathan Oliveira, who was a Bay Area artist. He taught at Stanford for many years in their art department.
John was actually a student of his.
Oh, you're kidding?
Nope.
Oh, that's great. So Nathan was very much involved with earth colors, not only because of how earth colors looked, but because he wanted to bring that earth energy into all of his work. And he especially had a strong relationship with orange and all of the earth-based oranges. One day he called me up and he said, Robert, I really need to use asphaltum. And he said, but you know, I've read about asphaltum historically and how terrible a color it was, that it aged, but can you make a copy of it for me? And it just so happens that the week before I had made asphaltum in a glass beaker as I was testing printmaking grounds. And so there I had it. You know, here's asphaltum, and I could see what its mass tone was on in the thicker areas, and I can see what the color of its transparency was through the thinner areas looking through the glass. And I said, no problem, I can do this for you. And so I made it for him initially as a custom color. And then that color actually made it into our line as our asphaltum.
Oh, wow. That's a great story. And it's the perfect person to ask about it.
Truly. And we had one other event with him is He was an early tester of our brown pink color. There are a few companies that make a brown pink, and everyone who does it has their own sort of proprietary mixture for what's going to be their brown pink. And so he was a tester of it, and he liked it so much that he asked me to make it as an etching ink for him. And so I made it about a gallon of etching ink, and he went to Crown Point Press and made a couple bodies of work just with that brown pink. And I own one of those beautiful prints, and it's always a wonderful memory of that time. Actually, I did it as a trade. I traded him the ink for the print, which was really quite nice. The ink is long gone, and the print is still up on my wall.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you got a good deal.
But perhaps the most important custom thing that we ever did was working with Wolf Kahn. Wolf Kahn, who is a second generation abstract expressionist who essentially took those concerns into landscape painting. He's worked in New York his whole life and in southern Vermont. And he was a mentor to me. I mean, through the 90s, I painted with him absolutely as much as I could. And he has an interesting painting technique. He has moved oil painting to be as close to his process of making a pastel as possible, which means he wants as many tints and grays as possible. And then he only does his color mixing on the surface. He doesn't do any color mixing on his palette. And so through his advice and support, that's where our whole line of Radiance and our Portland grays came from.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
Thank you. And so for the listeners who have not had any contact with Radiance, they're merely a small color wheel of high intensity tints. And in order to find out which one was going to be, you know, radiant yellow or radiant red, I made a value 7 tint out of every pigment in the factory. And the ones that were the highest intensity became that radiant. And so you might think that, oh, cadmium red's a really strong color, so maybe radiant red is cadmium red. But I found that the tint of perylene red was the strongest red that we had in the factory. And so the radiant red is a tint of perylene red.
Ah.
Just as an example.
That's an excellent lead-in to my next question, which comes from Christina Rotelli. And Christina wants to know, what is the difference between radiant white and titanium white? And is it better to use to make tints? And if so, why? And you sort of, it's a three-part question, so we can break this up if we need to. But the last one, I think you just answered it, which is how and why did you develop the range of radiant colors?
Well, she has a three-part question, and I consider this probably the most important thing we're going to be talking about today, and I'm going to add another couple parts to it. Because essentially what she's done is she's opened up the door to talking about the value of white in the painting process.
Yes.
And so it's not just a question between radiant and titanium. It is a question about which white is going to support my work the best. And when you look at our color chart, you'll see that we make 9 different whites. We think that this is, you know, we only make 100 colors and 9 of them are whites. And so you can clearly see that we feel that the question of white is absolutely the most important thing in terms of the whole painting process, purely because probably the central value of the color chart, if you were to look at it that way, is maybe a value 5 at the highest and maybe down to a value 4. And then you look at the world around us and the world exists at a value 7 or 8. And so in order to pull the whole palette of colors up, white becomes our tool to do that. And so it ends up with most oil paintings as being at least 50% white paint. And for many paintings, it could be 75% or more of the paint that actually makes it onto the surface is white. And therefore, white is very much in the driver's seat of what the whole experience of painting is all about.
I have so many. Okay, sorry. I have so many questions about this because I typically just like I picked one white and I use that and I don't really understand the difference between all the whites. So I think there's probably a lot of people that are like that. So this is a great topic.
I want to refer all your listeners to our white chart. It exists right in the middle of our color chart. All of these whites are listed with all of the characteristics. It's available on our website where our whites are discussed. You'll find this chart also. And the chart lists all of the colors. It talks a little bit about their characteristics, but it rates them all in terms of their drying rate, what oil they're based on, what their tinting strength and their opacity is, what their color temperature is, and just exactly what their texture is, whether they're really, really stiff or they're really sort of buttery or whether they're soft. And so I feel that artists could use that as a beginning point to really sort of, because so many of us, you know, our teacher used this white and we introduced this to it. And so we've sort of stuck with that, and whether it whether it's the best for us or not. And so just to give you an example to answer your listener's question, the difference between titanium white and radiant white is generally what drives most of the differences is that titanium white is based on linseed oil and the radiant white is based on safflower oil. So that leads to the titanium white being a little warmer in color because linseed oil is slightly yellow and safflower oil is not. Mm. And therefore, the radiant white is going to be more neutral in color. The titanium white is naturally faster in drying. It has more linolenic acid in it, and so it combines with oxygen in the air much more readily, and so it dries naturally faster, which means radiant white is going to be slower in drying. They both have similar tinting strength. So they're both the strongest tinting strength, have the most titanium in it of any of the other whites. And so they're going to be definitely the strongest whites. Mm-hmm. But the difference that we've built into it is that the titanium white has a more buttery texture and the radiant white has a softer feel to it. So, you know, we can't tell you which of these characteristics is going to be more important to you. And so we've tried to build all of a huge variety of characteristics into these whites so that the artist can find one that most perfectly meets their needs.
So then the difference is radiant dries slower.
Yeah.
Because it's safflower oil, you said?
Yes.
But the tinting strength between radiant white and titanium white is equal.
It's the same. Okay. Yeah, same tinting strength. The differences are going to be dry time and color temperature.
And the texture.
And texture, yes.
What did you do and how did you change the texture? Why did you just do that so that you would have some variability for the artist experience?
Yeah, just purely for variability. There's some artists who really want the paint to be absolutely as workable as possible out of the tube. And we can't do that with every color. We can really only do that with white. And so we can give you a white that is softer, that when you put it in with every color, it's going to make them really very brushable. And so that's a quality we built into that. With most of the whites, they're going to be more stiff than that because you may want to use them with a painting knife. And so the soft texture is not going to be appropriate for a painting knife. And mm-hmm. So we've only made a couple of colors that are soft so that they are really very brushable easily out of the tube.
As a follow-up question to that about the whites, Hosiah King wanted to know what gives flake white replacement its consistency? What sort of additive process is used? And he's comparing it to titanium.
Well, I'd like to tell the story about flake white replacement. The reason it exists is because we as a company have done all that we can to make oil painting absolutely as benign and as safe as possible. And so the beginning part of that is to get all of the toxic pigments out of the palette. And so we do nothing in lead, mercury, or arsenic. We do nothing in really strong solvents. And so that means we've never had a lead white. We've never had a flake white. But as an artist and as a paint maker, I tremendously value the contribution that lead white has made to the history of oil painting. And I felt that even though we weren't going to come out with a lead white, through my considerable skills as a formulator, I felt that I could give artists a paint that worked absolutely like lead without having any lead in it. So in order to kind of open up the process, There's a painter, Robert Barnes is his name, and he taught for many years at Indiana University. And I used to run into him at least once a year at the College Art Association meeting. And every single year he would needle me. He said, "Robert, when are you going to start making lead white? I love your colors, but I'm never going to use your whites because I only use lead white," you know. And it was just this running joke between us. And, you know, I'd gotten to the point where, like, I'm ready to do this lead white thing. I've got time for it. And so I called Robert Barnes up and I said, "Robert, I want to formulate a lead white and I think I can do it, but I need your help. I'm going to make these whites as close as I can to the working properties of lead." And that's an interesting thing, because to start this, I bought every single lead white on the market and I looked at them in detail, and like, there was not one that was like another. They were all very, very different from each other in terms of their textural properties. But I think there's one thing that we sort of can agree on, that lead white is heavy and dense in its texture, and it is relatively opalescent in terms of its tinting strength and its opacity. I mean, this is one of the reasons why so many portraits from the past look so absolutely lifelike, is because of the opalescent quality of the lead white that sort of relates to the semi-transparency of the skin.
Mm.
So I said, you know, we can agree on what these characteristics are, and I'm going to work with my materials. I'm going to make a white that matches these. And so we started with letters of the alphabet, batch A, batch B, batch C, and I would send him to Robert, and he would call me back and said, "Oh, it needs a little bit more this, a little bit more that." And finally, one day, we were to batch N in the alphabet, and the phone rings, and Robert's on the phone. He says, "Robert, I can't believe what's happening." I said, "What is it? What's happening on your palette?" And he said, "I got your latest copy here, and I keep reaching for my lead white and I can't tell the difference between them." And I said, "Robert, that's not a problem. It's time for us to go to press." And so that's when we released our flake white replacement. And,
wow.
And that's the story of it.
Wow. That's a great story. I love it. It's great that you took the person who was, I don't want to say most critical of it, but you know, he was very invested in it.
I needed a tough audience, because that's the only way I was going to have confidence in what we had achieved.
I love it. I have a couple questions about technique. Alice Riley wants to know what advice you would give an artist who's never used oils before, and where would you begin?
I think that is a great question, because there are many painters, you know, he get involved with painting through acrylics and then they get ready to sort of move up into oil paints and they're not quite sure how to do it, or they've been watercolorists for many years and get tired of trying to protect the painting so much as you have to do with watercolor, and they want to try oils. And so here's a few recommendations on how to get going. I mean, if they're already a painter, whether it be a watercolorist or acrylic painter, then they've got a familiarity with a certain palette of colors that they like. I think they should start there. Go out, accumulate a few colors that you're already familiar with, and start there, because you know how they mix, they know their value to you. And then as time goes by, if you find that you need more colors, then you can add to it at that time. But I think starting with what you already know, because there's so many other things that are going to be new, let's not throw in color mixing as something that has to be learned also.
Mm, good advice.
But going back to one of the first things we talked about is get into our color chart or our website and try to carefully choose which white. I mean, I could say, go get some titanium white like the rest of the world does and start there. But I would really think, if you got a little time for research, look at the color chart and try to choose one that sort of matches at least with your dry time. I mean, you may know, like, I want my paintings to dry really fast, or you're going to want to paint for days on end. And so try to find a white that supports that. And if you want me to tell you which white to just start with and you don't want to deal with that, then I would recommend picking up the titanium zinc white. I think that would be a good place to begin. And then in terms of the painting medium, this can get very complicated for an artist. And so as to really simplify it, I think they should begin with what we describe as a low viscosity medium. These are the mediums that have been with us from the very, very beginning of oil painting. We make two of them that are really quite nice. One of them is Galkid Light, if you want something that dries a little faster, or Galkid Slow Dry, if you want something to dry a little slower. But it's not going to be complicated. It's just going to take paint, and it's going to thin it, and not really try to do anything fancy with the paint in terms of making an enamel-like surface or to making an impasto. It's going to be just really sort of straight ahead. Now, concerning surfaces, I would recommend right from the beginning that they buy one or two stretch canvases and one or two panels, because they work so differently, and the experience of painting is going to be so different that they should experience right from the beginning what it's like to work on a stretch canvas versus working on a harder surface, working on a panel. And both of those are available now for very inexpensive prices through art supply stores. And then with brushes, I just would like to recommend that there are so many brushes available that they at least buy a couple stiff brushes, hog's hair bristles, and also a couple softer bristles, because just like working on a different surface is going to be different, working with these stiffer or softer brushes is going to be very different. If you want to work with stiff paint, the stiff brushes are going to be very good. If you want to work with thin paint, the thinner brushes are going to be really very valuable.
Nice.
Then the last thing I want to mention about starting is there are many painters who begin by painting on using paper palettes, those disposable paper palette pads of paper palettes. And I think that's totally okay. But I think that the experience of painting is greatly enhanced by having something that is more permanent. I could recommend something as simple as some painters like to work on a sheet of glass. I personally don't like that because the glass is so hard, but a piece of very smooth plywood is absolutely a wonderful surface for paint mixing. Mine, which has been, I'm looking at it right now, has been worked on hundreds of times, and it just sort of glows with this beautiful, deep luster that it has.
Yeah, because it absorbs all the oil, and eventually you get like a glass-like surface.
Exactly. And just one tip about taking care of a palette is clean up every day, and then that palette will be perfect for you when you come. There, you see many painters, and you know they never clean up their palettes, and it becomes a real difficult time in order to work for color mixing.
Do you clean it entirely off? Like, I know a lot of people keep the colors on the side.
Yeah, the sort of reservoir where every color is not changed, but the mixing area is cleaned every day.
Yep.
And I want to mention one thing for the beginning painter that I think is very valuable. Painters sometimes will not discover this for many years down their career, and that is to lay out your colors in a perfect chromatic arrangement, especially starting with yellow over to one side. What this does is it keeps yellows away from all of the things on your palette that are going to make it want to turn green. And so if you want a nice, pure, clean yellow, you will have an area of your palette that has not been sort of mixed with, because so many things on the palette want to make yellow turn green.
Yes.
And we even have this technique in one of our videos. On our website, they can search for navigating color space. And there's this little discussion of setting up the palette this way.
That is fantastic. Another question related to technique comes from Jeannie. And Jeannie has a color theory conundrum. She says, why do cool objects cast warm shadows and warm objects cast cool shadows?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure I totally agree with all of that assumption. But, you know, the color of objects is a function of the color of that object on its surface and the color of light that's falling on that surface. So, for example, if you have a warm-colored object and its shadow looks cooler, then the color of the light must also be cooler. So, you know, let's say you have a red vase that's lit with a yellow light, and that red vase is also sitting on a red tablecloth. So the shadow would also be warm in color, but it would be cooler than the vase because there's less yellow light falling on it. So from my perspective, it's an additive thing. You know, you have the color of the object and you have the color of the light. And if you take one of those away, then you have, let's slightly change this around, because with landscape painting, we frequently find that objects, say a tree, looks very warm because it's lit with warm light and its shadow is going to look very cool. Well, generally that shadow is being lit with the color of the sky, which is blue, and the tree is being lit by the color of the sun, which is yellow. And so you get, regardless of what the color of the objects are, the color of the light is different. And so I'm suspecting that this artist is really reacting primarily to a difference in the quantity of and the color of the light that's falling on the object and also falling on the shadow, because there is light falling on the shadow. It's just not as much usually.
Yeah. And then you also have reflected light coming up from a surface that will affect it too.
Yeah. It gets very complicated.
Yeah. So one of the last questions I have for you, Robert, comes from Sean Sullivan. He's saying that he prefers the old Gambar that you had to mix yourself because he feels like the consistency was better. It's less likely to bead up and you could brush it on as thickly as you want. So is there any chance of bringing back the old formula for those who prefer it, is his question. Although he understands why you have the premix.
Yes. And I find this question a little bit confusing. And I have heard it just once or twice before that artists think that the premix Gambar is different from the ready-made Gambar, or actually the kit form and then the ready-made, that there's a difference between them. But they have absolutely the same formula. Gambar was developed at the National Gallery around 1990 by the work of René Delarue. And I used to go to the National Gallery every year, and I met with René, and I discovered his work. And I asked him if he would work with me, if the National Gallery would work with me to bring his formula, his work, to the studio artist, because it was such an amazingly stable varnish that required such mild solvent. It's an amazing material to have access to. And so the National Gallery worked with us and we adapted his formula very slightly. Essentially, what we did is we added more resin to it because the conservator generally is accustomed to varnishing a painting very, very, very lightly. Mm. And then the next day looking, okay, it needs a little bit more over here and just varnishing that spot. It needs a little bit over here and varnishing that spot. And then the day later coming back and looking at it again and varnishing a little bit. So they use very, very mild varnishes. And for the studio artist, we needed a resin concentration that was going to allow virtually all artists to, you know, varnish once and not have to go back and do it again. And so that's the work that he did with us to adjust his formula. And that's the formula that was in the kit version. That's the formula that is in the pre-made version that we have now. But I can understand where people think like, oh, they changed packaging, so they must have changed formula, where in essence, we haven't. And in our own work, we've been using it since we developed it in the early 90s, and like, I don't see any difference. Mm. And so there may be some change to that artist's technique in terms of the paint layers. Maybe they have a slightly different, you know, medium to paint ratio that is changing how Gambar lays down for them. Now, this issue of beading up, I don't necessarily want to take a long time with it now, but if artists have that issue, they can contact us through our website, and we have a series of techniques to help with that. Essentially, what's going on is that Gambar is a very low viscosity fluid. Mm-hmm. And just like when you spray water onto a freshly waxed car, that water beads up because the difference in surface tension between the surface of the car and the surface of the water. And that can happen on a painting. If a painting is very, very sort of glassy because it has a lot of medium in the surface of it, or even in a spot, then Gambar is going to bead up because it is low viscosity. And we have techniques for helping artists to deal with that.
The next question comes from Edgar Soberon, and Edgar says that he's used Gambling Colors for many years, and he also enjoys using many of your boxes and mediums. He also likes your informative website. His question is the following. He's found that the oil and the pigment are separating inside the tube with much more frequency in many colors. Can you talk about that a little bit? Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, and that's a great question from Edgar. So essentially, oil throw is what we call this when you have the separation of pigment and oil. The oil is being thrown from the pigment. And this is a completely normal thing. In fact, some separation of oil can and is very possible to happen in all oil colors over time.
Mm.
Essentially, what you should keep in mind is that the larger the tube, the larger the container, the more oil is in the tube, and the more likely this is bound to happen over time.
Mm.
From our studies, because we've done a lot of work into this, finding out what causes it, we found that the major contributions are age, one, the age of the tube, and heat. Heat and temperature plays a major role in oil throwing inside the tube.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed that.
Yeah, and I know it can be a real messy situation for some painters, but they should be assured that it's completely normal to happen. Kind of like how peanut butter separates in the jar. You can expect an oil paint to sometimes throw its oil. We could load up all of our colors with stabilizers to prevent this, but we've chosen not to, mostly because we want to keep our formulas as simple as we can and not load them up with stabilizers to prevent that.
Gotcha. So what's the best practice for people who experience that? Do you recommend? Because I know a lot of people take it, you know, they may squeeze it out on a piece of cardboard or something like that to absorb the oils.
Well, it's really a matter of preference. If the paint is still workable with a brush or a knife, it should be usable regardless of oil throw. But if the artist really wants to get the viscosity of the paint more oily, then just simply adding a couple drops of either a fine linseed oil or safflower, for example, and working it with a palette knife should get the color back to its original consistency.
That was a great explanation of what happens with an oil paint. Thank you so much, Mary. I'm going to switch it over to Pete Cole now. Pete is the president of Gamblin Artist Colors. Pete, my first question comes from Ryan Reynolds. Ryan asks, what do the folks at Gamblin think about water mixable oil paint? And does Gamblin have any plans to produce their own line?
We don't have any plans to introduce a water-soluble oil. And I'll tell you why, and I may go on a bit, but it's important to us. Our mission as a color house is to lead oil painting into the future. So we are very happy to leave things in the past of oil painting. We're unafraid to do that. If we thought water-soluble oils were the future of oil painting, we would absolutely make them, and we would try our hardest to make the best water-soluble oils. But we don't feel that way. And fundamentally, they are just a terrible compromise for the artist. As a painter, when you switch to a water-soluble oil from traditional oils, you give up a tremendous amount of pigmentation. Your colors are just less intense across your entire palette. The working properties of water-soluble oils are also quite different. So you don't just lose some of the opacity in colors, you also lose texture and a lot of mark-making possibilities when you go from traditional oil color to water-soluble. The sort of promise of water-soluble oils is that you're somehow safer. And that's just not the case. The way that they're made is essentially taking what would be a traditional oil color. There's less pigment. There's soap and other chemicals added to make them easier to clean up. And there's a bit less linseed oil, perhaps.
Hmm.
So essentially, you're no safer. You've taken out a bit of pigment. You've added soap. And the material itself is no safer. What you have is a slightly easier cleanup, and a cleanup you can do without solvents, but you can accomplish the same thing with traditional oils by working a bit more simply, removing solvent from your process and using our safflower oil soap and water or even dish soap to clean your brushes. So in our view, water soluble, the artist just gives up far too much in terms of possibilities for their work and gets very little back. You get a slightly easier cleanup process, if that.
What exactly is it that is toxic in the paints? I know the solvents are, and I know there's concern about particular colors, cadmium, lead being like the obvious ones or the ones that we hear about the most. But it sounds like what you're saying is that there's additional additives that go into the water mixable oil paint, but you still have the issue of the pigments.
Correct.
And then they're just reduced.
Correct. Nothing has changed on the pigments. You know, the pigments that we're using in an oil paint are generally the same pigments that are in a watercolor or an acrylic. We're all working from the same sort of universe of pigments. So to your point, you're not really changing anything on the pigment front when you go from a traditional oil to a water soluble. You're really just giving up a lot of color and mark making possibility and getting back a slightly easier cleaning process. So to us, that's a really bad compromise and bad deal for the artist. You touched on kind of one of the great myths of oil painting or misperceptions, and that it's that somehow there's something just inherently unhealthy or bad about oil paints, and that somehow acrylics are more responsible, a more responsible material to work with. And that's just not the case. If you look at what they're made of, fundamentally, oil paints come from a field and your acrylic paints come from a refinery. Oil paints are made with linseed oil, which to most of us is known as flaxseed oil, same thing.
Oh, okay.
And it's essentially food. You know, flax is in muffins, it's in your oatmeal, it's in cosmetics, moisturizers, it's a vegetable oil from a plant. That same plant, the flax plant, also gives us the linen that we paint on. The seeds of it are pressed to give us linseed oil that we make our paint with. And the stalk of the plant is stripped and woven into the linen that we paint on. So there really couldn't be anything simpler about it and more natural about it. And by contrast, when you work with acrylics, that is a plastic, and plastic is derived from, you know, a drum of crude oil. And so to me, if a painter is looking for natural materials to work with and to be around, oil paints are absolutely the answer. I can talk a bit about pigment if you'd like.
Yes, I would love to hear about that. So can you give me a rundown of which pigments have a reputation for being very toxic and what alternatives are there, or how can artists best work with them? And then what are the ones from your point of view, from your knowledge, that really are toxic? And what are the ones that are just sort of getting a bad rap?
Sure. I'll start by just talking a bit about sort of the three eras of pigment history. And these are things we explain really fully on our website and in our color chart in particular. And the history part of it is interesting, but what really matters is how this information helps artists build the right palette for their painting. So I'm happy to have folks listen to me, but the web is also, our site's a great resource, and in particular, our color chart. You've basically got three eras of pigment history. So the first era of pigment history begins with the colors of kind of classical oil painting. So those are your siennas, your umbers, basically your earth colors. And these colors are mined rocks. Your umber, for example, is a mined rock. Your burnt umber is umber literally burned in an oven to shift the color of the pigment. So when you're painting with an earth color, you're painting with the linseed oil we talked about a few moments ago, which is essentially food. It's a vegetable oil. And you're painting with rock. And as an artist, you could consider that inert. It is as dangerous as a rock on the beach to you. The next era of pigment history are the colors of impressionist painting. And this is your cobalt and your cadmium colors, for example. And basically what happened, the blast furnace was invented and mankind threw all manner of things into the blast furnace to see what would happen. And one of the things that we discovered was that burning different metals at different temperatures produced a whole new range of colors. And so over a relatively short period of time, after, you know, a few hundred years of just having different colors of earth pigments to work with, artists got cadmium red, cadmium orange, all these incredible new colors based on metals. The third era of pigment history are all the colors that are hard to pronounce. Your phthalos, your quinacridones, dioxazine. And these are colors which are essentially pigments created to serve modern industry. So they are relatively less expensive than a cadmium color. They're more intense in their tints. They're consistent, and they are essentially a lab-made pigment based on carbon that are made in sort of a lab environment. In terms of safety, people talk a lot about cadmium colors, and they have concerns about them. And I think in general, they're vastly overblown. First of all, if you look at the health choices we all make in our own personal lives, whether that's eating red meat occasionally or worse, God forbid, painting with cadmiums is like one of the last things to possibly worry about if you're concerned about your overall well-being. They are not kryptonite. Their cadmium doesn't sort of emanate badness. It's a metal that you want to avoid eating and you want to avoid inhaling. And as far as avoiding eating, I hope that's self-explanatory. As far as avoiding inhaling, the thing to do is not to sand. If you were to paint a painting with a bunch of cadmium colors and then you were to sand it down with a power sander, let's say, and inhale that dust, that could cause problems for you over a long period of time if you were doing that a lot. Mm-hmm. If you were working with cadmium pigment loose and you were messy and you were inhaling it and not wearing any sort of protection, that could cause a problem for you over the long term. But if you're a painter working in your studio, you really are completely safe. There's artists that wear rubber gloves because they feel they need to. That's not the case with our cadmiums. You can't absorb them through your skin. There is nothing sort of coming off of them. People worry about off-gassing. There is nothing coming off of them. And so really the concerns are just kind of, the trouble is there's as much misinformation out there in the world as there is information. Mm-hmm. And we've always worked hard to clarify that, but these things take time. And I'm glad people are asking questions about it and concerned about it.
But then why does everybody think that? Where did all this start? Why are there so many misperceptions about the materials?
I have a two-part answer for that. The first part really relates to the use of turpentine in the oil painting studio. And in large part, this has basically been entirely eliminated. And turpentine is really hard to find in oil painting studios. But if you went to art school in the 50s, 60s, 70s, even into the 80s, you were exposed to turpentine and you were exposed to a lot of it. And it was not fun. It was not good for you. And it's very memorable.
Yeah.
In addition, you know, during that era of painting, most mediums were a Damar-based medium. And Damar is a resin that in order to make it fluid, you need a really strong solvent. You need to use a turpentine to create a medium with Damar. So not only did you have a whole bunch of turpentine around for cleaning brushes, but you also had turpentine in most all mediums that oil painters would be working with. That's all in the past now, but I've been around turpentine a lot in my youth, and it doesn't feel good. You remember it and you stay away.
Yeah.
And I think it's a shame for oil painting, but it's a vestige of the past that we're still dealing with and unwinding today. And Robert has really moved oil painting forward by bringing artists Gamsol and bringing artists a range of mediums that don't contain any turpentine at all. So I think that's one thing that drives it. And I think the other one for me, and perhaps for you, I remember working with old oil-based house paints, which are now pretty much banned in most states. But if you were painting kitchen cabinets or doors or trim, you used an oil paint. And that was, of course, an oil paint derived from petroleum distillates and other chemicals, not linseed oil based like our paints. And folks that remember working with those paints as I say, painting large monochromatic works, i.e. walls, they're not fun to be around. I think for some people, that's another source of the misperception, is that oil means chemicals or crude oil, when in fact it's flaxseed oil, it's linseed oil, it's safflower oil. So I think those, for me, those are the two big drivers of that misperception, and turpentine is certainly the biggest part of it.
Yeah, I remember painting with turpentines too. It was awful. So I want to go into the next question. Mark Bushnell wants to know if there's a safe way to use water-soluble paints in a small studio with no ventilation to speak of. And he's asking because he lives and works in northern New England, and he doesn't particularly want to open a window for some fresh air in the wintertime. And Kumar also has a very similar question. He's working out of a basement. So what advice do you have for artists who are working in small, enclosed places?
Yes, yes. I grew up in Maine, and he has a point, for sure. I think that this is sort of easily solved, and I'll give you kind of a couple of options. The first option is just to work without any solvent at all. And for people who are, there are people who are super concerned about these things and want to keep it simple, that's great. So work with traditional oil colors, whether they're ours or anyone else's. Work with our solvent-free mediums as your medium. We offer a liquid version, or fluid version rather, and also a gel version. For cleaning your brushes during your painting session, we offer a safflower oil. You could use linseed oil if you wished. That would be fine. We like safflower better.
Why is that?
We like safflower because of the clarity of color that it has. It's a little bit paler than linseed. And we found in our own testing that that during your painting session, it cleans actually quite well, and certainly better than linseed oil. And then for cleanup at the end of your painting session, you have a range of options. My favorite is not cleaning my brushes at all. And I'm sure there are a number of listeners out there who's, that's also their default technique. So you can certainly do that. You can leave your brushes to soak in safflower oil or linseed, which doesn't sort of eat at them the way that a harsh solvent could. Or you can use a master's brush cleaner or ivory soap to give your brushes a final cleaning. So in short, with this kind of process, it's the same as cooking, basically. You don't have anything more dangerous than what you might cook with. You don't need any special ventilation. You don't need to open a window. You don't need to have a fan. You don't need to do anything. Just paint and don't worry about a thing. If you want to use traditional mediums like our Galkids that contain some amount of Gamsol solvent, or you want to work with solvent like our Gamsol for brush cleanup, that's fine indoors as well, especially for one person painting at home, in their own home. Normal airflow in a house, if you have any kind, first of all, if you live in New England, you have a drafty house, because we all did. We all still do for the most part. So like it or not, you've got some airflow. And then you've got just natural airflow from opening and closing doors, you know, coming and going from the house. And as long as you're using Gamsol solvent in any sort of responsible way, you know, just reasonable amounts for brush cleaning or thinning your color, you don't need to have an open window. You're not going to have a problem. And this is something we've tested fairly extensively in our own lab. And I do this. I don't worry about it at all. Some people do, though. And I would rather have someone comfortable and confident with their materials than sort of always a little bit uncomfortable. So for that person, the solvent-free approach, I think, is best. But otherwise, consider Gamsol for thinning and for brush cleanup, even in Vermont and even in the winter.
Nice. Nice. Okay. The next question comes from Larry Madrigal. And Larry writes, since I'm days away from becoming a dad, I'm trying out the Gamblin solvent-free medium and gel to paint in the studio with my newborn. Can you mix anything with this particular medium, like wax, to reduce the shine? I don't usually prefer gloss. Also, he's wondering if you have any other solvent or toxic-free tips for painting with a baby in the studio.
Sure. So first of all, congratulations, Larry. My first recommendation to Larry would be to consider using our Gamvar matte varnish or our Gamvar satin varnish. What that's going to do for you, Larry, is saturate your colors, unify the surface of your painting, and get you a uniform matte look to your work. The matte is obviously pretty much a dead matte finish. The satin has a bit of gloss to it, but less than what you're seeing by mixing your oil colors with our solvent-free mediums. So that would be my first recommendation for you to consider. The other thing you might consider is using our cold wax medium mixed into the solvent-free mediums. This is really only going to work for you if you like the texture that cold wax gives colors and if you like the feel of it in your painting process, and you may not, but that's another possibility. Cold wax does contain a small amount of Gamsol, so it is not a solvent-free medium, but it's minimal. If that bothers you, don't use it, but that's another option for you. I think really by far working with the Gamvar satin or the Gamvar matte is going to be the best thing for you. In terms of other studio safety considerations with kids, you know, with a newborn, you're certainly a ways away from having someone in the studio going through things. But I think that's an important one, of not having young kids have access to a studio and everything in it without any adult supervision. I think that's the one thing to consider for you. If you're working with oils, you're working with solvent-free mediums, there is no other concern or consideration that I can think of. There's much more hazardous things in your kitchen and in your bathroom and in your garage than in your painting studio when you're working with our colors and our solvent-free mediums.
So the next question comes from Jean McLean, and she's wondering if you can use Gamvar as a retouch varnish.
I would not recommend using Gamvar as a retouch varnish. And rather than use a retouch varnish, we would recommend a technique called oiling out. Oiling out is, if you have a painting you've been working on for a while, oiling out accomplishes the same thing as a retouch varnish, but without the damar, without the turpentine. And we think it's an easy process. And what you're basically doing is applying a mixture of 50% Gamsol and 50% Galkid or Galkid Light, if that's what you have around, to your painting. And you just apply a thin glaze layer, allow it to soak in for a couple minutes, and then just wipe or brush away any excess. And what you get from that is you're essentially feeding the surface of that painting with oil, with fat, and that helps to bring up the colors that have sunken in a bit as they've dried, your earth colors, for example. And you get that same effect as you get when you work with a retouch, where you get a good look at, okay, am I done, or am I ready to varnish, or do I want to keep painting? And we feel like that's a better approach and an easier one. And there's more information on that on our website, but that would be our recommendation. And I would say, do not use Gamvar as a retouch. Gamvar is designed to be removable and easily removable with Gamsol at any time. So it just is not well suited to do the job of a retouch. Oiling out is a much better approach.
And you guys also have a video about that on your website, right? It kind of shows them exactly how to do that.
We do.
So going back to the sort of 101 of painting, why varnish in the first place? What does that do for your painting?
It's a great question. And we've seen kind of broadly like a resurgence in interest in varnishing. I'll talk a little bit about that. Traditionally, varnishes were made with damar. And again, that means you're working with turpentine, and it's not fun to be around. Damar varnishes are also incredibly difficult to remove. You really need a conservator to do it. And they tend to darken with time. So there's just a lot of artists that just kind of gave up varnishing or were never taught it. Mm-hmm. If you fast forward to today, our Gamvar is no damar, no turpentine, virtually no odor, dries quickly. And it's essentially the easiest way to make your painting look better. That's why if an artist asked me, why should I varnish my painting? I wouldn't give them a lecture about permanence. I'd say, you know, it's the easiest way to make your painting look better. Why is that? As we all know, different oil colors dry to different surface qualities. Some colors become a bit more matte and muted as they dry. Other colors remain more glossy and a bit more intense as they dry. And when you varnish, you essentially you saturate color. So you gain saturation. You gain that depth of color back you had when you looked at the painting and it was wet. And then you get a uniform surface quality throughout your painting. So for me, the aesthetic reasons alone are reason enough to varnish. Mm-hmm. The other nice thing you get is, yeah, you have a protective layer on your painting that you can easily remove with Gamsol. And for a lot of painters out there, I'm sure you're thinking, you know, I'm not going to do that. The odds of me going back into an old painting are pretty slim. I get that. But if you have a painting hanging in your house for 20 years or so, and you have some texture to it, you're going to have this accumulation of dust and dirt on it. And if you really like that painting, you might want to consider cleaning it, and you can do it yourself just by using Gamsol. You're able to remove that varnish layer along with all the dirt or dust that's accumulated on it. And then you can easily re-varnish and put the painting back up on the wall. So I'm not going to go around lecturing painters about that, but it's a really nice possibility. But really, varnishing is just, it's just the easiest thing you can do to make your painting look better.
And then regardless of the type that you use, whether it's gloss or satin or a matte finish, do they still give you that same deep saturation, that same richness of color?
They do. They absolutely do. But you're going to see more of that with a gloss varnish. You're going to see that deepening and saturation of color with the matte as well, but just not to the same extent, because by definition, what a matte varnish is doing is diffusing the light bouncing off that painting and coming back to your eye and making it look more matte. So you're not going to get the same color saturation you see with a gloss, but you're going to get more than you had before you varnished, for sure. Another thing I'd mention as well is that Gamvar works great on both oil paintings and acrylic paintings. So for folks out there that work in both mediums, that's something to consider.
Okay, got it. We talked about these next two a little bit, but I just want to make sure that we specifically talk about this. Jeremiah Polachek is asking if there's a good alternatives to cadmiums that are opaque, which aren't as toxic. And we covered a little bit about that, but are there alternatives to cadmiums?
Yes and no. You can match the mass tone of a cadmium color with its sort of counterpart in the range of modern colors. So what's he saying? What I'm saying is if you're working with cad red medium and you look at naphthol red, you're going to find that naphthol is a pretty close match to cadmium red medium in mass tone. The trouble, as the question points out, is that not only is the opacity not there, you've actually got some transparency and you have a color that mixes and tints very differently than that cad red medium. Mm. And so this is what makes cadmium so special. This is why I paint with a palette of weighted towards cadmium colors, is that they really are very special colors. And as of now, there's things that are similar and, you know, you know what they are and you can try them, but they're just not the same. And that just sort of is what it is.
Okay. Okay. But as we talked about before, this is presupposing that cadmiums are highly toxic. So maybe with that new information, that's not as much of a concern. Jeremiah actually was a guest on the show. So I would be able to follow up with him.
Yeah, it's sort of one of those things, like you could find a lead pencil around, and if you write with it or draw with it, you're really not going to have problems. If you eat it, you know, or poke yourself with it, well, that's different. And and with cadmiums, it's the same thing. You know, paint with it, don't eat it, don't sand and inhale it, and you're fine.
This question comes from Fiona McLean, and Fiona is asking what Gamblin's opinion of retouch varnish is. She is worried about using it because she's heard that it might crack.
Yeah, the recommendation is basically don't do it. We have the same concerns about permanence as other people do about retouch. We don't make one. They generally use a harsh solvent that we wouldn't want our people to be around or that we wouldn't want to be around. And oiling out is just a better, easier approach to get you to the same place.
Gotcha. Beautiful. Okay, next we have a question from Claire Ramsburg, and Claire wants to know how to get started using cold wax mediums with oil paints. So can you give me sort of a cold wax 101?
Great question. We get lots of questions about cold wax, and it is a very versatile and fabulous material. For those of you that are listening and maybe haven't heard of cold wax or are interested in it, there's great information on our website that'll go through in more detail how to work with cold wax and some of the things that are possible with it. A few things to highlight. It basically, cold wax medium kind of blurs the line between oil painting and encaustic. The cold wax medium makes colors thicker and more matte. And because of the stiffness of the cold wax medium, it holds the sharpest and kind of thickest of marks. So you can really build up texture in your painting. You can carve back into your paint layers using a palette knife. And you can also work with it in thinner layers with a significant amount of medium, say greater than 50%, 60% of the mixture and a little bit of color, and create sort of translucent glazes, translucent layers of paint, much like what you can create using encaustic techniques. Unlike encaustic techniques, you don't need heat. There's no melting of the wax. None of that is part of the process. You can work with the medium straight out of the container, mix it into your colors, and it's completely compatible with all of our other oil painting mediums.
And then what would be some do's and don'ts for cold wax? What should people look out for?
I think the first thing is dry time. Cold wax has a dry time that's a good deal slower than oil colors themselves. So the more you use it, the more that you're going to extend your dry times. So a thick layer could be 10 days and maybe even more in some environments to dry. So you're going to have a slow dry time. The other thing to bear in mind is that you're working with a wax and it dries to essentially the consistency of a beeswax candle. If you drop a candle, you know what happens. And so the cold wax medium is quite flexible, mm-hmm. which is good in terms of permanence, but it is certainly less flexible than an oil paint film. So we would recommend working on a panel rather than working on stretched canvas. And I'd particularly say that because a lot of cold wax painters are working big. They're working mm-hmm. 4 feet and up. And with a stretched canvas of that size, you're going to have movement and you're going to have a fair amount of movement in that surface. And so we think a panel is a great choice.
Very cool. Thank you. I've been having a lot of fun with cold wax also. Debbie Underberg-Mueller would love a rundown on your new solvent-free mediums.
There's three products in the range of solvent-free mediums. The first that we introduced is a solvent-free gel medium. The second is a solvent-free fluid. And then the third is a safflower oil. And the idea with our range of solvent-free mediums is to give artists maximum possibilities with minimal compromise versus using traditional mediums. And I think we've done really well in that regard. The solvent-free gel medium, if you don't know which one to try, it's the one I would recommend starting with. It's easier to control just on your palette mm-hmm. Because it's a gel. It has a body similar to that of oil colors. So it doesn't sort of immediately make your colors really watery and completely different than they were. Mm. It's just easy to work with, forgiving, and it speeds the dry time of oil colors up by a day or two, depending on the colors you're working with. And for most people, a little bit faster dry time is going to be appreciated. The fluid medium is what it sounds like it is. It's a fluid version of essentially the same materials, slightly slower dry time than the solvent-free gel. But for people who like a fluid medium, it's a great choice. The safflower oil is our recommendation for what to use for cleaning your brushes during your painting session. We want artists to be able to have something they can work with that's safe to get into their painting. And there are cleaners out there that work very well, but you don't want them in your painting. Mm. And safflower oil, of course, painters have been using it for hundreds of years. We bind colors with safflower oil. There's no issue whatsoever. It works well as a cleaner. And like, to some extent, like Gamsol, pigments will settle out of it a bit and the top portion of it will clear. And so you can really reuse it and recycle it in a way that other cleaners that you wash down the drain, you can't do that with. So we feel like it's a real responsible way to clean brushes during your painting session.
Oh, that's nice. I didn't know that it actually, so if you leave it sitting there, it actually separates. So you can pull out the clean, you can have multiple jars if you want to.
It will. It takes a lot long for those of you out there that are used to working with Gamsol and how that goes back to water clear overnight. Safflower oil is not going to do that. I don't want to overpromise anything, but it will a bit, it will settle out. Whereas other cleaners, all the pigment stays in suspension and you have that, you know, gray to violet mm-hmm. wash that really doesn't wash very well. And safflower oil does better than that. These mediums are not sort of newfangled in any way. They are very, it's a very simple formula of materials that we and artists have been working with for a really long time. And it's basically the same alkyd that's been in our mediums for years that's derived from soybean oil, and then an alkyd derived from safflower oil. So you've basically got two plant oils in there that you're working with. So this is not new in the sense that it's technical or it's a chemical or anything like that. This is vegetable oil.
Nice. Okay, got it. And so then just to kind of recap it a little bit, because I think I interrupted you. So you have the gel, you have the liquid, and you have the safflower oil, and all of those help you to manipulate the consistency of the paint and the drying time. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, so I have a question for you, and this sort of ties into a question that Edgar Soberon was asking. He was concerned about oil and pigments separating, and I'm kind of curious about the longevity of oil paints, how long they last, because I kind of had this funny story. Apparently, long before I was born, my dad was sort of like this entrepreneurial type guy, and he was an art materials distributor. So when I went to, so now we're talking, let's say that might have been in the 60s and I was born in the 70s. And so in the late 80s, early 90s, I go to art school and my mom, being very diligent, goes into the garage and she pulls out this box that has like all this stuff from like the 1960s or yeah, like 1960s art supplies.
Right.
And there's all this paint in there and I opened them up and they were fine.
Right.
So how long does paint actually last? Because those tubes of paint by the time I used it were over 30 years old.
The shelf life of an oil paint, you know, in a tube is basically forever. As far as I can tell, there are some colors that over time, the pigment will continue to absorb oil and they'll become stiffer over a period of years if you're not using the paint. So a sienna or an umber might do that. If you had a 3 or 4 year old tube, it might continue to kind of absorb oil and get a bit stiffer in the tube. There's other colors over a period of a couple of years or more that will relax and release a little bit of oil. And a cadmium might do that. Cadmium red light might do that. You might see a bit of loose oil after a period of years, but the paint itself is completely fine and the pigments completely fine. There's not really reason to be concerned about using that old paint you got from your grandmother or a friend. And you'll just see a bit of that separation. If you stress paint by leaving it in a hot garage or the trunk of a car, mm-hmm. that can also cause a little bit of separation. And this is true of all oil colors. And it's been true since, you know, oil painting got started 600 years ago.
The last question I have is from Christina Rotelli. And Christina says she loves Gamblin paint and she loves your great technical help on your website. But she finds the caps on your tubes are very small and become difficult to screw back on after using a tube a few times, especially if wearing gloves. Any chance of rethinking the cap size?
I completely agree. I was painting yesterday and I will paint again today. And I will drop a cap into the sand and struggle to find it, just like some of our listeners have from time to time. One of the things we get asked a lot and one of the things we steered away from is just making the neck of the tube larger. And I don't want to do that because people, it's kind of like toothpaste. toothpaste tubes all went to bigger neck sizes and we all use more toothpaste than we need to. And that's great for manufacturers and less great for us. So one way for me to get a bigger cap is a bigger neck. And I just won't do that. I don't think that's fair. And I think we could, you know, you could get away with it, but I'm not going to do it. The thing that we are looking at and working on is different threading that will make it easier just to get them lined up and on. And I've had that problem. Most other oil paint makers around the world are using similar tubes, similar caps. So it's something I hear a lot. I actually have a lot of painters who call me and tell me, I love your caps. Please don't change a thing. And then I have other painters who say, I can't believe these caps. Can't you do something different? So we listen really carefully and we have a pretty clear sense of what we will and won't do as a color house. And, you know, a bigger neck that just causes you to kind of use more paint, that's, we're not going to do that. We'd rather you complain about our cap being hard to put on than that we do something that wastes the paint that you've purchased from us. So I'm hoping we'll get there in a year or so, but I agree. And I could give you a lecture about make sure the threads are clean, make sure that you wipe them before you put the cap back on, and that will help. But, you know, I don't do it. My caps are as messy as anybody else's. So, you know, that will help, but we all know that we're not going to follow those instructions. So I'll dispense with that lecture.
You guys also have a product called Fast Matte. What is that? What does that actually do for you?
Fast Matte is a range of oil colors that dry in 24 hours and they dry to a matte surface. So why would we make that? The impetus for it really came from the studio. And I think all of us have had this experience where you get into the flow of a painting session. Maybe you get an underpainting in and things are going really well, or you're deeper into that painting and you reach a point where you have to start making some decisions about, am I going to stop and wait for this to dry and try to hang on to this idea and hang on to this momentum that I've got? Or do I keep pushing and run the risk of maybe I'm not getting the marks I want because I'm layering wet over wet rather than over a dry layer? And it's just a bummer. It's just not a fun place to be when you feel like you're really in the flow of this painting and it's going really well and you're kind of forced to stop and literally watch paint dry while you try to hold on to that idea. So that's what we're trying to address with it. There's sort of three uses that we see for Fast Matte where it's really helpful. The first is just a plein air painter who's chasing light and chasing shifting weather. And you're kind of on a clock when you're plein air painting. You know, you can't pause. And so the Fast Matte colors will start to set up and dry as you're working. And so for you, you know, you're painting in Italy right now, your early layers of that painting will be dry enough and have enough, a bit of tack to them that you'll be able to make marks over them, get kind of that broken mark over them without the colors mixing together. Mm. And you can get that right there in your painting session versus having to wait and come back the next day. Another great use for them is just anybody who's painting big or thick, where the fact that oil colors dry slowly becomes maybe more of a problem when you're working really big and thick. Those dry times get a little longer. And so I see a lot of painters in LA that don't want to wait for anything and paint big, paint bold, paint thick. And they love Fast Matte because they can work at the pace they could with acrylics, but with the power of oils. So that's another place that they make sense. And then another area which I touched on is underpainting. The Fast Matte colors are terrific for that. And this is where the matte surface really becomes useful. All the colors have a matte surface and it's got a nice tooth to it. So as you layer over that underpainting, you're getting in the surface of the painting is literally kind of pulling the paint off the brush. So it's a fabulous tool for underpainting as well. But the general idea, you know, Bob wants people, he wants everyone to kind of find their flow in oil painting. And for him, you know, he's at his happiest when he's in the flow of a painting session. And so the idea was, how do we get people you know, into the flow of their painting session faster, and how do we enable them to stay there longer? And that's the idea behind FastMat.
Wow, I learned so much from Gamblin today. That was fantastic. Thank you so much to every single one of you who submitted your questions to Gamblin. Robert, Mary, and Pete covered a lot in this episode. They stuck it out and made sure they answered every question. If you'd like any of the resources that they mentioned in this episode, they've put together a special PDF download for Savvy Painter listeners who sign up for their email list. Just go to gamblincolors.com/savvypainter to get your free Varnishing Made Easy PDF. You can connect with Gamblin on Instagram at instagram.com/gamblincolors. And of course, if you have more questions for the folks over at Gamblin, or you want to follow up on anything that we've talked about, they are super approachable. Head on over to gamblincolors.com or give them a call. Tell them I sent you and let them know that you heard this episode. Until next week, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter Podcast. Thank you so much for listening.